8:13 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Utah Legislature's 45-day general session chugging along. On the phone with our weekly recap, I have KPCW reporter Emily Means. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So last week, U.S. Senator Mitt Romney broke rank with his colleagues when he was the only Republican to vote to convict Donald Trump for abuse of power. He's definitely been criticized by the president leading up to the vote and certainly in the days following. So how has the vote been received here in Utah? Of course, he made an unexpected, I think, visit to the Utah legislature last week.
Sure. Romney visited the legislature on Thursday to meet with Republican leadership. That's House Speaker Brad Wilson and Senate President Stuart Adams. He met with them to explain his vote, which they both kind of disagree with. But mostly they kind of seemed concerned about the fallout from the vote. And like you mentioned, President Trump has criticized Romney in the days following. So Wilson and Adams are sponsoring a resolution to show the legislature's support for the president. You'll remember a couple of years ago now, I think, President Trump visited Utah to undo the Bears Ears National Monument designation made by former President Barack Obama. And the legislature really liked that, or Republicans in the legislature did anyway. They think Trump is a big ally for the state. So that's kind of what this resolution is about. Although it hasn't been numbered yet, it has been made public, but the text isn't available. So we'll kind of see more details in that as it's numbered. But another lawmaker, Representative Phil Lyman, who's a Republican from Blanding, is sponsoring a resolution to censure Romney. And that basically means that the legislature is formally showing its disapproval of Romney's vote. So that bill also hasn't been numbered yet, so we don't have the text for that yet. But, you know, a lot of Republicans in Utah are pretty displeased with Romney's vote here. So I think it is worth noting, though, there was a rally in support of Romney's vote. You know, lots of signs saying, thank you, Mitt, and that kind of thing. But mostly on the Republican side of things here in the state, at least at the legislative level, we've seen some discomfort with Romney's decision.
Okay. And my understanding, too, that Governor Herbert does not support Phil Lyman's censure. And I guess it's only in words only. It doesn't really mean anything.
Right. And, you know, Governor Gary Herbert wasn't at this legislative leadership meeting on Thursday with Romney. But from reporting, it seems like he's not a big fan of censuring Romney. So, again, we haven't seen the text of these resolutions yet. And for people who aren't sure what a resolution is, it's basically the legislature just stating their position on something. You know, it's not creating a law. It's just showing how the legislature feels about a particular issue.
Okay. But that's not their job, right? I mean, their job is to pass a budget and pass bills.
Well, there are lots of resolutions. I mean, you know, this year we're seeing resolutions to go to all year-round daylight savings. Or there was one I reported on last week about, you know, encouraging school districts to change their start times to a later time. So it's something that the legislature does and that they're able to vote on. But, you know, whether or not it's their responsibility to pass these positions, I guess depends on what voters think about it.
Okay. What about Representative Tim Quinn's bill that would allow voters to recall sitting U.S. senators?
Yeah, Tim Quinn, a Republican from Heber, he was at this meeting with Republican leadership and Romney last week. And his bill, which is House Bill 217, we have reported about before. He says that it's not about Romney. When we talked with him a couple weeks ago when this was made public, you know, he said that he began drafting the bill long before impeachment hearings began. And he made clear to Romney that it's not about him, but, you know, the bill might be dead anyway. Legislative lawyers believe it's unconstitutional, although Representative Quinn told me that it's his job to make laws, and if someone wants to challenge it, on the basis of its constitutionality, they have every right to do that. So we'll see how far it goes in the legislative process, but I expect some spirited debate when it hits a House committee.
All right. This week, Utah celebrating a big milestone in women's history. Not only is 2020 the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, but the 150th anniversary of Utah granting women the right to vote. Tell us what's going on for what Utah Women's Suffrage Week.
Yeah, Utah was 50 years ahead of the rest of the country on this issue. And last year, the organization Voterize helped pass a resolution designating February 14th as Women's Voter Registration Day in commemoration of the day 150 years ago when Utah women cast their first votes. So pretty exciting events going on this week, especially if you're excited about history and those sorts of things. On Wednesday, there will be a celebration at the state capitol for students, for K-12 students. They'll have different activities and storytelling, that kind of thing. And then on Friday, if people want to head down to Salt Lake, there will be a march from City Creek Park, which is at the bottom of State Street, essentially down the hill from the Capitol. So there will be a march from that park to the Capitol in memory of women who inspire you. And, you know, they'll have like little pins and things like that. Voterize will be there to register voters. And then I also noticed that in commemoration of the 150th anniversary, Voterize will be at South Summit High School today and tomorrow to register students to vote. And also I'll have a story today that kind of gets into a little bit more detail about some Wasatch Back women who are involved in women's voting efforts. So it's pretty exciting for women in this state. And there will be a big celebration at the Capitol this week.
All right. Let's have a look at the education legislation. A lawmaker there proposing a constitutional amendment to allow voters to decide whether state school board members should be elected or appointed. Currently, they're elected. So how come they're doing this?
So this kind of stems from a Utah Supreme Court decision recently that allows for school board elections to be partisan. And we're talking about House Joint Resolution 13 here. It's sponsored by Representative Melissa Ballard, who's a Republican from North Salt Lake. She actually ran this resolution last year as well. And a senator from Salt Lake, former Senator Jim DeBacchus, who is a Democrat, ran the same resolution in 2018. But basically, the governor has expressed a desire to appoint state school board members and also the state superintendent. He does this with state judges, and then the Senate votes to confirm them. But this year, the school board election will be partisan, like I mentioned. So people will be voting for, you know, their state school board representative as a Democrat or as a Republican or however their party affiliation is. And, you know, the governor currently appoints the Board of Regents, which is the governing board for higher education. So I think it's this thought that most people don't really know who their state school board representative is anyway. You know, it's a bigger race than your local school board race. And so the governor believes that future governors should have that ability to appoint school board members because, you know, the governor kind of sets out this budget anyway, right? We talked about Governor Gary Herbert's budget and how he really emphasizes education. But in the end, you know, who's in charge of determining what happens with that budget in regards to education and different educational policies. So, that's something that we'll see. There's a House Education Committee hearing today. I didn't notice this resolution on its agenda, but perhaps the agenda will be updated. So basically, let me explain a little bit further. The resolution would create the possibility of a constitutional amendment. So this would actually go to voters, presumably if this resolution passed, It could go to voters this November, and then a majority of voters would need to approve the constitutional amendment, and then it would take effect in January of next year.
All right. The Hatch Center, this is the policy arm, and I'm guessing the fundraising arm, of the Orangey Hatch Foundation, announced Saturday evening that it will be hosting an event with Supreme Court Justice Clarice Thomas. The announcement came at the Utah premiere of a new documentary sponsored by the Hatch Center on the justice's life, Created Equal, Clarence Thomas, in his own words. What can you tell us about this? I don't even know if tickets are available.
I can't tell you much more about it. I looked on the Hatch Foundation's website, and this event isn't even listed. But, you know, we received a press release on this. It'll be May 15th at the Grand America Hotel in Salt Lake. And the press release from the Hatch Foundation says, former Senator Orrin Hatch says Clarence Thomas is the American dream personified. And then for ticket information, people will need to contact the Hatch Foundation. So I wish I had some more information about this. It is a few months out, so maybe there will be more information that we can update people on.
Okay. Again, the third week, what have we got to look forward to?
You know, this legislative session has kind of been off to a slow start. You know, the first week, they repealed the tax reform law that they passed in December. And besides that, you know, there hasn't been any defining moments, really. Last year, we saw the Medicaid expansion repeal early in the session, and then there was a big focus on tax reform. Last week, during his legislative update to City Council, Park City Manager Matt Dias didn't really have anything to report. His thought is kind of no news is good news. But there are a lot of bills that have been filed, so I expect things will pick up a little bit as we get closer to the end of the session. But this Romney item that we mentioned earlier has really kind of been, you know, the biggest thing of recent weeks. So
yeah. Always makes me nervous, though, when they wait so long last minute. I don't know if it's just things get pushed through that we don't know about, or think bad bills get voted on just because they're out of time.
I think a lot of people have concerns about the process because it really does kind of all pile up on the back end. And just as an example, I reported on a bill this past week that would remove the straight party, straight ticket voting option on your ballot. So, you know, do you want to vote all Democrat? Check yes. All Republican? Check yes. And Representative Patrice Arendt, who's sponsoring that bill, has run it for like the past 6 years or something. And last year, it actually made it through the House committee and then the full House and then the Senate committee. And then it got stuck in like the last few minutes of the session in the Senate, and it wasn't heard. So I think it's a point of frustration for not only constituents, but also legislators, as their bills just kind of end up on the tail end of the session with no time for discussion.
Okay, Emily Means, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
That's KPCW reporter Emily Means. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. 8:31 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, coming up on Thursday evening, Park City resident and author Kurt Repinchek will be at the Swanna Preserve reading from his new book, Rebisoning the West, Restoring an American Icon to the Landscape. Kurt Repinchek joins me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Well, first, just start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself. I mean, you worked as a journalist for years, and I guess you still do that as
decades.
Part of... Yeah.
I started in the last century.
Yeah. Well, a lot of us can say that, yeah. But then you've kind of founded and now CEO of the National Park Traveler, which is, I mean, you're still doing some reporting. That's about reporting, yeah, the national parks?
It is. It's a hybrid between a daily newspaper and a magazine. It's a nonprofit media organization that focuses solely on national parks and protected areas. And, you know, any day of the week, I mean, Sunday night we were writing about the flooding that shut down Mount Rainier National Park. And today we might be doing something on the president's proposed budget for the next fiscal year. And so it's, you know, drawn on my AP background, whatever comes up that seems newsworthy, we pass on. And as well as there's travel information, travelog information. And we also have a podcast that we do, a weekly podcast that we try and complement the daily news content with the weekly podcast content.
So you have boots on the ground then covering all of this, or is that just something that you're kind of pulling out of all of the just sources and making some sense out of it?
A little bit of both, a little bit of both. I mean, we've got some writers based around the country, one in District of Columbia, one in San Francisco, one in Florida, Northwest, Northeast. And so I've got a pretty good network of commissioned freelance writers as well as, you know, volunteers who really help out quite a bit. And we get a lot of news releases coming in through the inbox.
Yeah. And you've been doing this now. When did you found?
August of 2005.
All right. So you got about 15 years into it. And it's obviously you're making a living doing it. No, you're shaking your head.
It is a nonprofit. We are looking for patrons.
Okay. And that's how it's supported.
Yeah, right? We rely on reader and listener donations. We offer advertising, of course, and sponsorships and whatnot. And we believe that we're really filling a niche out there because, as you well know, the dot-com boom of the 2008 or so really took down the legacy media, took down a lot of news organizations. I think since 2014, 1,500 or so newspapers have gone by the wayside just because they can't compete in today's world with Google and Facebook taking 80% plus of online advertising.
So the new book, why did you think this was a story that needed to be told?
You know, back in, I think it was 2017, I ran into Dan Wenk, who at that time was the superintendent of Yellowstone National Park. And this kind of goes to the problem of the media. He was lamenting to me that he was approaching the Washington Post and the LA Times and the New York Times about doing a story on the whole bison issue up in Yellowstone with brucellosis and how they were having to kill thousands of bison a year or hundreds of bison a year because of the brucellosis disease that they were carrying, which carries the chance for spontaneous abortion in livestock. And I said, well, Dan, I can do that. I mean, we're not paying for newsprint. You know, we're just taking up space. Pixels and whatnot. And as I was working on that story with a colleague up in Wyoming, I recalled that the Interior Department had an initiative to put bison back in places in the Midwest and the West where it was appropriate. And so that became a tangent of this story on the Yellowstone brucellosis story. And when we got done with that series, I just kept going. And I thought there was a really good story to tell here.
So what's the status of the American bison?
What's the status? You know, on North America, the continent, there's about 500,000 bison. And far and away, the bulk of those bison are in commercial production. They're for meat generation. They're for hides or skulls or whatnot. Roughly 20,000 are in what is called conservation herds, which are intended to preserve bison as a species. And right now, the Park Service has been sampling, I think there's 18 federal herds on Park Service lands and some BLM lands and Fish and Wildlife Service lands, and they've been sampling them for DNA and blood to basically see where they descended from, because at the end of the 19th century, there was only about 500 or so bison left, and out of those, there was five or six what's known as foundational herds that all of today's bison can be traced to. And so the Interior Department and Park Service have been doing, like I said, DNA testing and blood analysis to be able to trace where all their herds came from. Because if they want to put a new herd, say, in Great Sand Dunes National Park and preserve, they don't want to take from herds that are closely related. They want to get, you know, a good, diverse gene pool. And the blood testing is designed to show if there's any cattle introgression, which basically is cattle genes, because towards the end of the 19th century and early 20th century, there actually were a couple ranchers out there who were trying to cross bison with cattle. They thought they could produce a sturdier animal on the landscape that wasn't quite as gruff to deal with as bison can be.
So we've got 20,000, I guess, roaming, which is a big cry from the 500 left. But to restore it or to re-bison it even more, is it that we need more bison, or is it that we need actually places to put the bison?
You know, I think if we have the will, we have places to put the bison. An example I like to point to is in South Dakota. You've got Badlands National Park towards the center of the state, and you've got Wind Cave National Park on the western border of the state. Both those parks have bison in them. They are surrounded or touch by national grasslands. And so in theory, you know, you open up those grasslands and you can connect those two national park bison herds. Now, that's a very simplistic way of putting it because there's a lot of things that have to be thought through and dealt with in that. In Wyoming, you've got the Thunder Basin National Grasslands, which back in, I think, 1996, a woman had done her master's thesis on putting bison back there. And it could be done if you drive through Thunder Basin today. It looks pretty much like it did in the 1850s in places. But at the same time, a lot of the national grassland has been divided up for livestock grazing. And so you've got, you know, grazing rights out there that you would have to deal with.
Yeah. So, I mean, is it important that we put re-bison the West? I mean, because it looks good or because it's good for the land?
Well, as you might recall, back in 2016, President Obama declared the bison the national mammal. So I think we should have some national pride in seeing the species continue. But bison also are a lot healthier for the landscape than cattle or sheep are. They graze differently. They don't graze as hard. They don't hang around riparian areas and churn them up with their hooves as much. They are slightly different in what they choose to eat than cattle. And so you've got a lot of the native wildlife do better with bison out there, as well as a lot of the wildlife that grew up, so to speak, alongside of bison.
So is a bison a buffalo? Are they the same animal? Do we just call it buffalo because of the song?
Yeah. They are different animals.
Oh, they are different.
Well, there's the water buffalo, you know, over in Africa, and bison is a bison genus.
Ah, okay. So the book itself, I mean, is it a call to action? Is it really just kind of the history of the bison?
You know, I think you have to look at the history to get to where we are today. Mm-hmm. And so actually the book starts 200,000 years ago and when bison came across the Bering Land Strait at the time, which was above water. And so I trace the history down and I come up to the 19th century and the near wipeout of bison and what was behind that. And the I picked out four saviors who each played a role in bringing bison back to where we are today.
So anything in here that as you were doing your research that really surprised you, terrified you?
You know, it's pretty interesting, a number of things. You know, one of the quote-unquote saviors I point to was Theodore Roosevelt. And, of course, he went out to the Dakota Territory to make himself a man, so to speak. You know, he was a dandy when he went out there, and he really wanted to lead the rough-and-tumble life. But one of the first things he did that first week when he was out there was he killed a bison. And he proclaimed to his wife that, hey, I've got one. I'm going to bring it home. And if you go to his home in Long Island, Sagamore Hill, you'll see the bust of the bison mounted in the house. What's really interesting is the four gentlemen that I point to all were bison hunters and all were bison killers. And they all turned into bison conservationists and really worked to bring the herds back.
All right. So, again, you're going to be speaking at the Swanner Preserve Thursday, 6:30 to 8. The cost is free to members, or otherwise $7 per person. Are you going to do a book reading in addition to the signing, or is it going to Q&A?
I've got a presentation, a slide presentation that kind of covers what I found as I was working on the book. It really was a fun project. I was a history major in college, and so being able to research the past and look into, you know, how these things evolved, the circumstances, was really a lot of fun. And then I come up to present day, and up in Montana, you've got the American Prairie Reserve and their effort to basically create a 3.5 million acre nature preserve, if you will. Some people call it a national park initiative. They told me it's not a national park initiative. It's designed to restore the landscape, the temperate grasslands that once sprawled over the Midwest and up into Montana. And, you know, we've lost that. I think there's 1% left in the world. And they're trying to preserve that and bring back the native species, such as the bison.
Yeah. So other than those that are on Antelope Island, does Utah have any bison?
Yeah. Down in the Henry Mountains, there's a herd, and over in the Book Cliffs. And what's interesting is the Antelope Island herd and the one down the Book Cliffs both descended from Yellowstone National Park bison, which are believed to be the purest of the bison left out there. And whether that's true or not, hopefully this DNA sampling and blood testing that the Interior Department has been working on will point to that. Some folks have told me that as we refine our technologies, we'll find out that, you know, all bison have some amount of cattle genes. And why that's an issue is one of the things that makes bison such a hardy animal on the landscape is in the wintertime during the really severe blizzards, their metabolism slows down. That enables them to survive those harsh, incredibly cold winter storms. Cattle don't have that. And so I guess there's a concern that if you have a bison with cattle genes, how does that affect the bison's metabolism? And that's something that hasn't been studied. And so it's an interesting question.
Hmm. And again, people can find out a lot more. Swanner, you do need to RSVP to swannerecocenter.org. Working on anything else at this? You're just taking a break.
I never take a break. Actually, I'm going to Florida next month to Everglades and Big Cypress National Preserve. There are some hard news stories that I'll be working on. Big Cypress National Preserve is one of the units of the park system that has active oil and gas exploration on it, and there are some concerns about the damage being done to the preserve that I want to take a on-the-ground, first-hand look at. And at Everglades National Park, of course, it's still recovering from the 2017 hurricanes, and so what's the situation there? And
they got big snakes. That's what's there.
Big snakes, right.
Wow. Okay, Kurt, great to see you. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
That's author Kurt Repinchek. Again, he'll be at the Swanner Eco Preserve Thursday night, swannerecocenter.org. Again, if that's something you'd like to reply to. KPCW News Time now, 8:44. Good morning. Well, the World Cup Freestyle International, a wrap in the studio with an update of the three nights of competition in our backyard on the slopes of Deer Valley is U.S. Ski and Snowboard Communications Manager Laura Collerton. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's start with freestyle.
Yeah, it was an awesome event. We had some big crowds, between 7,000 and 8,000 people, I believe, each night. The U.S. team felt the love. On Thursday night, we kicked it off with some moguls competition, and Park City native Nick Page made his first ever finals under the lights on Champion in front of his hometown crowd. He ended the night in 10th, and it was just a really special moment for him, so super happy about that. Hannah Soar had a career best with fourth place that night, and Jesse Andringa had another career best in 11th place in singles. Wasatch freestyle skiers and Parkites Casey Hogg and Madison Hogg both made their World Cup debuts, and Casey finished in an impressive 19th place. So that was really great experience for them as they move up in their careers. On Friday night, we had aerials, and we had four men and four women compete in the finals under the lights. Kayla Kuhn, new rookie, made her first super finals, had a career best in 5th. Winter Vinecki finished just off the podium with her best Deer Valley finish, best career finish in 4th place. And we had an American on the podium that night, Megan Nick. It was her second only super finals, and she came in 2nd place with her first career podium. A note on aerials that night, just we had perfect weather and a flawless venue, so the men really put on a show, and we had two quintuple twisting tricks. So that's 5 twists. Not unheard of, but definitely unusual to have two perform so well and landed in a World Cup competition. And that just speaks to the wonderful venue that Deer Valley builds for us. So that was a really exciting night. Dual moguls, crowd favorite, was an awesome night. The women of the moguls team showed us their might. 3 were competing in the finals. We had Hannah Soar, Jalen Koff, and Tess Johnson. Tess, with the MVP move, beat until then undefeated Perrine Lafont from France in her quarterfinal, which allowed all 3 women to compete in the semifinal, which guaranteed us 2 podiums. Hannah Soar earned her 2nd podium of this season with a 2nd place against Canadian Justine Dufour-Lapointe in the big final. And we had some friendly American fire in the small final with Jalen and Tess dueling it out for 3rd place. Jalen landed on the podium and Tess came in 4th. Up next, the World Cup competition continues for aerials in Moscow this weekend, February 15th, and the Moguls team has a bit of a break. They'll be training here this week with competition resuming in Japan February 22nd and 23rd. Also, Deer Valley is hosting a NORAM event, which is the level of competition below World Cup for regional club skiers. So that's February 12th through 13th.
Oh, okay. That seems new. I don't know that they've done that in the past, have they?
I believe they have hosted NORAMs before. I don't think we had one at Deer Valley last season, though.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And the Alpine side of things?
Yes. So sadly, we heard of the unexpected passing of Michaela Schifrin's father, Jeff Schifrin, on Sunday. The family held a private memorial last Friday with close family and friends. And Michaela and her family are just so overwhelmed with the outpouring of love and support, especially from the ski community. So Michaela's in Colorado with family, and her return to competition is unknown at this point. But she's very thankful for everyone's kind words and thoughts.
Okay. And I'm just guessing her dad would say, get back there. Right?
Yeah. So yeah. We'll see. It's just, we'll see what she decides.
Okay. In the meantime, then, women are in Germany?
Yes. The women competed in Germany. Saturday's downhill, Breezy led two women into the top 20, landing in 17th. Alice Merriweather was 19th. And on Sunday's Super G, Alice Merriweather had a career best in 14th. Breezy Johnson was 18th. Alice McInnes and Jackie Wiles both DNF'd, but are okay. And the men were in Chamonix, France for a slalom and a parallel giant slalom. Neither Luke Winters or Tommy Ford qualified for a second run, but Tommy Ford scored a career best PGS result on Sunday in fourth place. This is his best since winning the Beaver Creek giant slalom event. And up next, the women head to Slovenia for a tech series, and the men head to Austria for a speed series.
Okay, and then cross-country?
Cross-country was in Sweden this weekend. During the classic sprint, Sophie Caldwell led four ski team athletes into the points. She finished seventh. Let me see. On the mass start freestyle, three U.S. women finished in the points. Jesse Diggins was 14th in the women's 10K. Sadie Bjornsson was 21st, and Rosie Brennan was 23rd. The men's 15K, we had Davis Norris post his best World Cup result of the season in 24th. And up next for the cross-country team, they head for a second stage race of the season, the Ski Tour 2020, which is February 15th through 23rd. And that's six races spread over 9 days in five different venues in Sweden and Norway.
Okay, and then for the free ski and snowboard teams.
Yes, they were at the Dew Tour, which was in Copper Mountain, Colorado, February 6th through 9th. We had some great results come off of that. Double Olympic gold medalist Jamie Anderson continued her hot streak during the snowboard team challenge. She was on double duty representing the team in both slopestyle and the street portion. She won each competition to work towards that victory for Team Oakley. Maddie Mastro found success in the half pipe, and she earned her second place in the modified super pipe. Slopestyle, Red Gerard was our top finisher on day three. He came in with the clutch on his final run and won the podium. This win checks an important box for him. He has now won three of the five pinnacle snowboard events, including Dew Tour, U.S. Open, and the Olympics. It's his first Dew Tour medal. On the women's side, due to heavy snow, they only hosted the rails portion of the competition, and Jamie Anderson won that, her 11th Dew Tour championship. Free ski, we had Salt Lake City native Alex Hall earned a second place finish in slopestyle, which is his best slopestyle result of the season, I believe. And he went on to win the street style event later that evening, and Parkite Colby Stevenson continued his impressive skiing, earned a best trick award. And for the women, Maggie Voisin earned a third-place finish for the slopestyle competition. This is her third-place finish of the season. And coming up next, the U.S. Free Ski and Snowboard Slopestyle and Half-Pipe teams continue to Calgary World Cup on February 12th through 16th.
Okay. See you next week, Laura.
All right. Thanks, Leslie.
Laura, joining me now in the studio, I have the Executive Director of the Park City Education Foundation, Abby McNulty. Good morning.
Good morning.
So today you wanted to talk a little bit about pre-K and I guess just how Park City Education Foundation helps with the pre-K program?
Yes. So Park City Ed Foundation, our mission is to lead the community in funding initiatives that inspire and challenge all Park City students to reach their academic and lifelong potential. And preschool is one of the 8 programs that we support, one of the key programs, largely because it has such an impact on all students to move the needle. So the primary objective of preschool is to prepare children for academic and social-emotional success. Every dollar that we invest in preschool, research shows, provides a $13 return to the community.
Okay. So how many kids do we have participating in it?
There's about 400 kids in preschool, and it's located in all the elementary schools in Park City. Mm-hmm. It's a 3-year-old program and a 4-year-old program. The 4-year-old program is a full day, Monday through Thursday. It mimics the school day, so it's an awesome alternative for working families who are, you know, want to do one drop-off, who have older children in the elementary school. What the Ed Foundation does is we provide dollars to the school district to allow for subsidized tuition to ensure that all families can participate in preschool who want to.
Okay. Again, is it something that you have to pay for if you don't receive some kind of...
Yeah, so preschool is tuition-based. It's not a program that is mandated by the state of Utah, the Board of Education, so it's optional. And so it is tuition-based. It's incredibly affordable, though. The program is about 10 years old, and I remember when I was doing the research back way when it started, you know, the average cost of preschool... you know, is like $10,000 to $14,000. And this offers tuition on a sliding scale to all families. It's a great, affordable, high-quality option.
Can you take everybody who wants to be part of it?
You know, that's a great question for Park City School District. And I will add that today is registration for preschool, which is perfect timing. And they're registering at the district office this morning from 8 to noon, and then this afternoon 3 to 4:30 at McPullen Elementary School. There is a wait list for the full day 4-year-old programs because, as we know, daycare is it's a need in this community.
Yeah. So you had mentioned that they're at all of the elementaries mm-hmm. that we've got going. So can this expand? Because we know that we're already kind of tight. Some of those schools.
Yeah, I think it can expand, and it's been part of the conversations that the school board and the school district are having as they're looking at, you know, redesigning the school buildings. And they have made some decisions. For example, the elementary school will be pre-K to 5, and then a 6, 7, 8, and a 9 through 12 building. So as they're looking at the campus through master planning, preschool is a part of the conversation.
Sure. And what is the Ed Foundation's annual contribution then towards this?
We contribute at minimum $100,000 each and every year. So we've been doing that for at least 10 years. So it's a pretty significant contribution annually. But again, the investment in early childhood is incredibly important to making sure that all kids are academically ready, that everyone's on an equal playing field.
Mm-hmm. And is the state funding any of this, or they're just dealing with kindergarten at this point?
Currently, the state doesn't fund preschool, but I have been alerted that there is potentially legislation that might provide funding for preschool, but that's to be followed through the legislative session.
Okay, so this all happens from taxpayers and then contributions from Ed Foundation.
Well, it largely happens from, because it's a tuition-based program.
Okay,
yeah.
Helps pay for itself.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. Yeah. Okay. And you know, some of the benefits of preschool are, you know, increasing high school graduation rates, it increases the years of college completed, and it also increases lifetime earned income.
You know that already just from preschool?
Oh, there's so much research. So the Federal Reserve Banks all over the states do a ton of research on preschool because it's a great investment in communities. Like I said, it, you know, the research shows it's $13 return for every dollar invested.
Yeah. And I see how you can get that kind of early on. But I mean, how can you start talking about graduation rates?
Well, I'm not talking about graduation rates in Park City. I'm talking about, you know, this is a high quality preschool program has demonstrated this around the country that have been, you know, programs that have been followed for years and years.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
On preschool, I don't have any additionals. Just a reminder that they are doing preschool enrollment today.
Okay. Abby, thanks for coming in.
Great. Thank you.